Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you with us today as we talk about adding edible ornamentals to your garden. And a couple of guests for you. One of them is Reba Lucan. She is director of the Allen Centennial Garden. Reba, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Larry. I'm happy to be here.
The other guest is Josh Steger, and Josh has been with us before. He's director of horticulture. Josh, good to have you back.
Hey, thanks, Larry.
So as we listen to these two talk, I hope you'll join in. Do you plant edibles in your ornamental garden? How's that work for you? You have questions about different varieties to try. I hope you'll join in. Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Or you could send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Reba, let's start with you. Welcome to the show again. You're relatively new to the garden. Tell us a little bit about your background.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I've been with Allen Centennial Garden since May last year. So I made it through one gardening season. They usually say it takes at least a full year to be at the garden to really know what's going on because everything changes so seasonally. So I'm almost there. But before I was at Allen Centennial Garden, I was in Minnesota at the Minnesota Landscape Arboretum. And I also recently finished my PhD at the University of Minnesota. So I have a background in plant biology, and then my graduate work was in history of science.
Very cool. And I was thinking, you know, long term, what are your kind of long term plans for Allen Centennial Garden?
Right now, I'm really focused on a few different goals. The first one is making sure that every garden within Allen Centennial Garden, right, we have all of these small different areas. We have a prairie and a woodland and a rock garden. I want each of those to really tell a story for people and to be put to some sort of use at the university. So right now, for example, we're working with a religious studies class, and they're helping us to better understand how gardens and food are a really important part of African and Afro-diasporic cultures, and how that can even have a spiritual component. So that's one thing. We also have an amazing rock garden, and so I'm just really trying to figure out why we're doing each of the gardens we are and how that is so important. And then my second thing related to that is trying to make the garden more diverse. So Josh, for many years, has been trying to make the plants more diverse and adding in the prairie garden and working on ecological diversity. But we're also trying to do more with cultural diversity as well. So we have a traditional French and English garden, but we want to have some more diversity in there, which is what we're trying to do with our kitchen garden this year also.
Well, one of my offices, I happen to have two offices here on campus, one for WPR and the other across campus. And it is very near the Allen Centennial Garden. And I view that as a perk to that office, the fact that in about 3 minutes, I can make it to the garden from my office. So it's a real perk. Josh, tell us about the plan to use edibles in the garden. What was the inspiration there?
Well, actually, the garden did something like this a really long time ago, actually way before my time. And just bringing these edibles back into the landscape, I think, is really important, that we're using all of our space, our green space, as much as we can. And the garden has always prided itself, excuse me, in creating these spaces with annuals and perennials. But it's like, okay, we can go beyond this. We can have a space that's filled with edible plants, too. Going beyond that beauty, using the space the best we can.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm thinking about the gardens that you're dealing with, or the pieces of your garden, let's put it that way. How do you go about the process for selecting plants, number one, and then deciding where they would go?
So a lot of it has to do with the soil types. One thing that I actually taught at, like, Garden Expo back in the day and other little courses that I've taught for garden groups is really looking at your site, paying attention to the type of light that it's getting, looking at the soil moisture, the soil type. And I think really embracing what the site is. I mean, I think a lot of us try to manipulate the site and try to make it what we want it to be, but I feel like, as I've learned as a gardener, it's good to work with what you have. And there are so many different types of plants out there that will flourish in these types of sites that you have. So that's kind of how we select our plants at the garden, based on the type of the soil and the site and the sun and everything else.
Is it, does the look come into play in terms of edible ornamentals that you, I mean, how they, you know, fit in with the other plants that are already there?
Yeah, definitely. When I'm building these designs, I think about, you know, color is important, but yeah. I kind of like to look beyond color and think about textures. I actually gave a lecture at Garden Expo right before the pandemic happened, talking about green as a color too, where that really focuses on different types of textures in the garden. And, you know, you have things that are tall and whimsy, light and airy. You have things that have robust, you know, leaves that are big and bold. And then you have some things that are in the middle that trail and fill in the gaps. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, to answer your question, that's, you know, and some things that we really pride ourselves in the garden is leaving the space what it is and just building it up. I like to have foundation plants that come back every single year. I don't personally believe in ripping out a space completely and starting over from scratch every year. I feel like it's a waste of plants and resources and a lot of things. So I think just building these gardens over time, and just building them up to what you want them to look like. You know, gardening takes a long time. It's not like it's all going to happen in like one season. So I think just building upon it and not starting over from scratch every year and using what you have and working with it is a way to do it. I think I answered that question.
Yeah, that's a great answer too, and thanks for it. Reba, talking about adding though, you're adding a kitchen garden to the property. Tell us about the kitchen garden.
Yeah, well, it's not, we have a kitchen garden, but we're remodeling the kitchen garden. So this is a project that's been in the works for a few years with the help of the Wisconsin Potato and Vegetable Growers Association and the Wyman family. We're looking forward to a new kitchen garden, which will be in the same place where we've currently been growing vegetables. Last year, we had a whole bunch of peppers behind the house. And so, again, increasing diversity this year. We're looking for lots of different plants there. But yeah, that's a project that has been in the works for many years, and we're excited hopefully to be able to put it in this year now that we've sort of gotten through that early pandemic stage when things got backed up a lot.
Yeah, I was kind of remembering that you had quite a variety of peppers back there.
Yeah, we had really fun peppers last year because they were all bred in the department, and so we had some hot peppers never released anywhere else that we could try out, and we had lots of fun picking peppers for weeks and weeks and weeks, and we set them out on the cart at the gate of the garden, and students just walked by and took them home and enjoyed them. So that was really fun.
That's great. And there's actually going to be a harvest festival in the fall, is there not?
Right, yeah. So all of this is sort of, we have this brand new kitchen garden that's opening. We're really excited about it. So we have ornamental edibles throughout the garden and this harvest festival. So it's planned for October 8th. We picked the date because that's when Erwin Goldman and the rest of the horticulture department usually does their pumpkin regatta. So yeah, we're going to try and coordinate with that. And then, of course, we have to plan around the football schedule. So we're working around that. But it's really exciting because we're going to be able to highlight the same cultures that we're highlighting in the kitchen garden. So instead of just having more peppers or tomatoes in the garden, we're planning a Three Sisters garden in collaboration with the Native American Health Professionals group. And we're working with Yusuf Benrilla in Trade Roots to do Aphrodiasporic crops, and the Groundswell Conservancy to do Hmong crops. And so we're going to have all of those cultures intermixed with some European flair also at the Harvest Festival. And I'm just so excited and happy to have the support of partners on campus, and we just found out that we got a grant from the Minnesota, or I'm sorry. See, I've moved to Wisconsin and I'm confused. The Wisconsin Humanities have given us a grant to help fund it, so we're really excited about that.
I was just talking with Irwin this morning, and we've sort of remembering that the Pumpkin Regatta kind of got its start on this program when Irwin was on the show, and somebody called in and told about their Pumpkin Regatta, and that it went from there. And I don't imagine you're going to have any giant pumpkins in that garden that you're talking
about.
Well,
we won't be growing them, but I did consult with Irwin. I said, if you have any extra, we'd love them for decorations, so maybe we'll have some. But no room in the garden to grow them, unfortunately.
Reba Lucan and Josh Steger of the Allen Centennial Gardens, our guests today. We've been started out by talking about the gardens themselves and about working edibles into their garden. And we certainly can talk about entering them into your garden as well. And I hope you'll join in with your questions and comments as we move along. Let me give you the number. It's 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us the email address, ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Jill Nadeau is our producer, by the way, and Tyler Ditter, our engineer. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Great to have you along for this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller, talking about growing ornamental edibles on the show today with our two guests. Reba Lucan directs the Allen Centennial Gardens, and Josh Steger, our other guest, is a director of horticulture there. So great to have them with us. Certainly, if you have questions, you can join in at 800-642-1234, or you could email us, email address, ideas@wpr.org. Maybe we could talk, before we go to the phones, maybe we could talk a little bit about some of the ethnic gardens. You mentioned the Three Sisters garden. Talk a bit more about that, what you've got, Reba.
Absolutely. So the Three Sisters garden traditionally has three different plants that are grown intermixed together that help each other. So there's corn that grows up nice and tall, and then there are bean plants that can vine up the corn. And then you have the squash that grows along the ground. And we're really excited because the Native American health professionals have seeds that they've grown before. They've done this kind of Three Sisters garden other places. And so we're going to be collaborating with them because they need a space and some people with green thumbs who can help them out keep the garden growing. I think any new gardener knows. Sometimes you get really excited, you start your garden, you get into the ground, and then there's the like upkeep and maintenance that has to keep going on all year, so we're going to be able to help them with that. But they actually have seeds from Oneida and other local tribes that they're going to share with us, so we're really excited to be able to cultivate those and help.
Yeah, and watch them grow. That's wonderful. There was an African garden. Talk about that one.
Yeah, the African garden is going to be with seeds that we got from True Love Seeds, which is an African seed company. I think it's in Philadelphia. Josh can maybe confirm that. But they it's a Black-owned company, and they're sharing seeds. We bought seeds from them to use with some traditional fish pepper plants and collards. And then Yusuf Benrilla grew an Afrodiasporic garden up by the state capitol last year, and Rue Genger in the horticulture department had one at West Madison. So they have saved seeds from last year that we're going to be able to use as well. And we have student help from that religious studies class, too, who are going to help us grow those and learn more about why those plants are so important and traditional to that culture.
And the Hmong, Hmong elders and the Groundswell Conservancy working?
Yeah, so I really wanted to represent some Hmong horticulture because I think it's something, if you go to the farmer's market, you'll notice there's a lot of Hmong growers in Wisconsin. They've immigrated here and in Minnesota, and so that's an increasing culture that we have, and I really want to make sure that it's something we can highlight as being an important part of state and the agriculture that we currently have. And So I was talking with them. I had a meeting with a bunch of Hmong elders, and it was in translation. So they were telling jokes and chatting, and I got conveyed to me that the thing that's really specific to Hmong culture is this chicken noodle soup that is given to women after they have a child. And so they grow a specific set of herbs that's really designed to help the woman's body recover and produce milk and all the things that a baby needs to help it grow. So we're really excited to be able to showcase that special cultural garden and food source that they have.
Somebody's going to call and ask, say, what are those?
I don't know. See, so apparently they don't necessarily have English names. So they're going to send me pictures and then send me to the specific market so I can say, I want this plant. And then we're going to do our best to have all of the labels, both in English and in Hmong, so that people will be able to figure out what they are when they're actually in the garden.
Well, let's take some calls. Grace in New Glarus, we go to you now. Hi, Grace. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. I just wanted to offer that what we consider edibles is incredibly depauperate. I've had a book for quite a long time. It's put out by Dover, like back in 1972, called The Golden Age of Herbals and Herbalists, and it goes back way back. Hundreds of years, and how during much of that time, up until like the 1800s or so, people didn't even consider a dish a salad unless it had 20 or 30 ingredients, and how everybody used herbs for medicine and for food and to keep themselves healthy, and a lot of things that we just think of as ornamentals and flowers were commonly eaten, and I think that's something that we need to expand our culinary pursuits to include is a lot more flowers and all, and I don't do nearly enough of that.
Grace, what a great story. Thank you for, and the book was The Golden Age of Herbs and Herbalists, but maybe comment, thank you for calling, maybe get a comment from Josh and Reba perhaps about Grace's comments.
Yeah, I'm happy to comment on that. As a historian of science, so my official degree is science, technology, and medicine. And I've been working with a professor at UW in the pharmacy school. His name is Lucas Rickert, and he does history of pharmacy, history of medicine. And so we've been talking about what are those pharmaceutical plants in the garden? Can we identify them? Can we grow more of them? And what are those? But you're also reminding me of a plant that I fondly recall eating called wood sorrel, which, can grow as a weed. But when I was an undergraduate, I worked at this environmental research station, and we spent all day weeding, basically. We were weeding these plots. It's called Cedar Creek Ecosystem Science Reserve, and they have this big field, and each plot is supposed to have a certain number of plants in it, 1, 2, 4, 16. But, of course, the plants will interseed. So our job was to get the plants out that weren't supposed to be in that plot in the experiment. And the favorite plant to find was wood sorrel because it's delicious. So we would eat our weeds on those days when we count those ones.
Josh, a comment from you.
This actually kind of makes me think about some of the people I follow on Instagram and social media. I don't know if anyone's familiar with the Black Forager, but her name is Alexis Nicole Nelson, and she posts these like TikTok videos on and Instagram videos on these edibles that where she lives that she uses in her cooking. And there's some things that she's shown us on video and talked about that I'm like, oh my gosh, I had no idea that was edible. I had no idea like how you where to prepare that. And I believe she lives in Ohio too, so it's not like it's the Midwest ish like where we are too. So thinking about this book that you just described, it makes me think of on the other spectrum, like social media, what people are doing, bringing all these edible things to light.
And what was her name? We might get her on the show sometime.
Yeah. So her name, her Instagram name is Black Forager, and then her name is Alexis Nicole Nelson.
All right, Alexis Nicole Nelson. Well, I'm just writing that down because it might be a great show down the road at some point. Yeah,
absolutely.
Ron in Oak Creek, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Ron.
Hey, how are you doing, Larry? I've just got a question. Probably I'm a gardener, part-time in the summertime. I just love to grow vegetables. And this year, I just grew them for a supplement. You'd always have tomatoes and beans and stuff like that. But, I've been buying seeds early because I'm thinking, wow, everybody's going to be doing this here because of the price of the groceries. But does it hurt any of the vegetable seeds to be frozen? Because I kind of stored them in the garage and I thought, oh boy, would it bother anything, So it's just kind of a silly question, but it's, something that I had a little concern with.
Yeah.
So maybe you could help me out there.
Yeah, well, not a silly question at all, Ron. Josh, do you want to start?
From what I know, I mean, some seeds, and this includes wildflower seeds, some need to be like striated in some way. They need like a cold, like to break dormancy, or you like rub them against sandpaper. So in terms of, you said they're still in the packet, like they're still, but they're just in the garage or something.
Yeah.
Yeah. As far as I know, they should be just fine. I mean, I think about like seeds in transit and stuff, and they could be coming from like colder places. I think they should just be just fine.
Yeah, if you didn't have them laid right down on the cement floor, or the concrete floor, that probably is. Does Reba, you agree with that?
I think so. I mean, I don't think, generally speaking, they probably recommend you bring them inside because you never know how cold it gets in Wisconsin, but a little bit of cold is probably normal for plants that are going to grow. So I'd try them out for sure. I wouldn't toss them.
No, and you can always try a little test first, too, and take some of the seeds and plant 10 of them, let's say, of a variety. And if 7 of them produce, that means you're probably going to get about 70%. So you can kind of do it that way, too. Just do a little test run. That'd be one way to do it. But thanks a lot for calling. I appreciate the call. And that was a good question, actually. You can join in, too, with your questions or comments as we talk about seeds and flowers, actually, and ornamental edibles with our two guests, Reba Lucan and Josh Steger from the Allen Centennial Garden. Number to call is 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us the email address ideas@wpr.org, ideas@wpr.org. Josh, let's talk about the varieties you're planting, some of the specific varieties that you're planting in each of your gardens.
Sure. Reba is more, she's taking over the new kitchen garden this year, and I'm responsible for the rest of the garden incorporating edibles into the rest of the landscape. Some of the places that I really pride myself in are the container gardens on the orientation section. That's where a lot of weddings happen, that's where people meet for tours, whatever. And these containers, I'm going to showcase a lot of edibles in them mixed with some annuals. And then as well, right across the way, we have a promenade, which is right in the ground kind of gardening. And I like to show the difference between the two, like container gardening with edibles and then like in the ground edibles, because like me, I don't own a home. I don't have property or anything. So I think it's really important that we still showcase people who don't have property or anything, how you can still have these edible ornamental gardens in a container. So some of the varieties that I'm trying out this year that I'm very excited about, one is Malabar spinach, and the Latin name for that is Bacella alba. We actually tried this one last year and people loved it. Like, I swear every time I walked by it or someone was like coming up to me, they're like, tell me what this plant is. And it's really cool because it looks like spinach, but it's a vine, but it's not spinach. It's a native to tropical Asia, so India, Sri Lanka, Indonesia. And like I said, it's a vine. So it has like these purple stems, these really big leaves, and they're different from spinach in that it's not spinach, but they also don't wilt like spinach does. You know how like you buy a bag of spinach and you cook it down and there's like not even a cup of spinach left over?
Yeah.
Like, but Malabar spinach, it will hold its form. It's yeah, there's a lot of texture to it. And I remember some of the volunteers after they were done volunteering, they like would pull leaves off and they're like, I'm going to put this on my sandwich later today. Or like, I know, I remember an intern literally just like taking like leaves off and just eating it like a rabbit. And like, you know, it was awesome. And the flavor of it is
what's it taste
different
like?
From spinach. Yeah, it's like a peppery, citrusy kind of flavor. And you want to make sure that you don't, even though, so the flowers on it are really, really interesting. They're like these little pinkish white spikes. And then once they fruit, it's these dark black berry kind of things. And they're not edible at all. The leaves are edible. But you want to be sure you don't let it flower because that's when the leaves start getting really bitter. And unfortunately, both of our plants last year ended up flowering, and there was just a lot of Malabar spinach left over.
The flowers were beautiful, though.
They were beautiful.
And everyone was really always wanted to know, what is that plant? It was so unfamiliar. Mm-hmm. And then, like, earlier this week, I was talking to the West Madison Garden Club, and they were all wanting to plant it this year after they'd seen it last year. And they were like, where do you get seeds? So, Josh, where did you get seeds for the Malabar spinach? That's the question. People want to know.
Yeah. So, like, I actually found them at Klein's in Madison, Jung's or Young's. I still don't know how to pronounce it properly in Madison, so I'm sorry. But you can also find it online. I found it on Seed Savers this year. So, It's widely available, and if you don't want to grow it, you can find it at farmers markets and Asian markets as well.
And Jung's is the appropriate way to pronounce the...
Thank you.
If you were in a commercial farm, there's a Jung's that is, you know, they're separate now, but one's called Jung's and one's called Jung's, and the Jung's one is the one you're talking about there.
Okay. Thank you, Larry.
For sure. Reba, any other comment before I take another call here on that?
Well, I was going to say, so like Josh said, I'm in charge of plant selection for the kitchen garden, and so I've been working with the communities we talked about before to help choose the plants and the seeds. I've picked a lot from True Love, from their Afrodiasporic collection. And we're also going to be planting some edible berries that are perennial in that garden. And I had some help from Emily at Wisconsin Food Forests to pick those out. So there'll be some currants and some gooseberries, hopefully. For not this year, they won't fruit, but in the future, we're looking forward to some more sweet treats in the garden.
Oh, that sounds great. Bob in Fond du Lac has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Bob. Thank you for calling.
Hello. I was reading something from Gaia's Garden, Toby Hemingway, and for the three sisters, he had some information about Chloemi. I think that's how it's pronounced. And Anastasi used to use that with the three sisters. That's a bee plant that attracts a lot of bees. And another something I read in the past was about adding nasturtiums to the three sisters because it deters squash vine borers, and I think I read something somewhere about throwing clover in with it also. But I've also read something about the seven sisters, and I can't remember what the seventh one might be.
All right, there we go. Are you guys familiar with the seven sisters?
I'm not. I have heard about a three sisters version. I forget which tribe it is, but they grow tobacco as the tall plant instead of corn. And then we were discussing possibly our Afrodiasporic garden will be three sisters too, but just with different crop plants. So we might grow watermelon instead of the squash to be our our base ground cover kind of plant.
Do you think nasturtiums actually repel those bugs, those squash bugs?
I don't know an answer to that. I mean, I know like the nasturtium is kind of like a spicy flower. I don't know if that, you know, keeps things away from it. They don't like that spice, but I have no idea, honestly.
It was an interesting, interesting combination. And the clover, I can see clover, it does add nitrogen to the, fixes nitrogen to the soil. Right. So that could well be a reason for planting clover, as and also would be edible too.
Right, and it's a good easy, probably cover crop too. So you know, when the season is done, we've talked about putting a cover crop in to overwinter it, so we don't lose so much soil when it's bare.
Thank you very much for that call. Appreciate it. You can join in too, 1-800-642-1234, or email us to ideas@wpr.org. And we should take some emails as well while we're at it here. Colin emailed, he's a big fan of the Centennial Garden, and many of his favorite college memories took place within those gates. thanks for that note. Here's another email. Oh, he's actually, I think Colin's wondering, how are students involved with the new kitchen garden and edible ornamentals? And what type of programming and interpretation will you have to make it more inviting for students without horticulture backgrounds?
Those are some great questions. First of all, there's one edible ornamental garden we haven't talked about yet this morning, and that is the corner garden. So out along Babcock and Observatory at the corner where we have our sign, there will also be ornamental plants. And we have a student who is helping design that as part of their capstone project. So to graduate with a horticulture degree, they have to do a capstone. And so one of our students from last year, who was our apprentice in the garden, is now moving up in the world a little bit and helping us to design that garden. So that will be full of student involvement, design selection, and lots of learning going on.
That's really cool. Maddie emailed, she's excited to see the revamped kitchen garden this summer. Do you have any plant recommendations for a kitchen garden that would be small enough for an apartment porch or even a windowsill?
Ooh, you know, I feel like this kind of like goes into the container gardening again. I think herbs are always a good choice. I think about, you know, the variety of herbs that are out there. I think about like all the recipes that ask for herbs. You're like, oh, a tablespoon of like fresh parsley chopped. And then you like buy this whole thing of parsley and then you have like, you have to use up the rest of it. So I feel like you don't have to go out to the store anymore. You can just have these herbs in a pot. I think there's also some tomato varieties out there that will do really well, like in a container. Actually, I was just talking to someone yesterday about a tomato variety that's really compact. And of course, I can't remember it now, but maybe I'll get back to you on that one. But I think herbs are always a nice choice. I actually, in the spring, I play with a lot of herbs in containers because, you know, it's those cooler temperatures, maybe some lettuce in there too. I think those are all really good choices. And depending on the type of light that you get, you know, some herbs can flourish, but, you know, generally they do like full sun. But let's say if you don't have a whole lot of light, I feel like I said, lettuce is really good. And maybe some type of like brassica or something.
I'm trying to remember the name of that. Is it Malabar spinach? Would that work in a container?
It would definitely work in a container. I've done that one last year in a container. They do like sun. That's the thing. So if we do put them in a container, make sure we can move them out to the sun. And they're just really beautiful in general. It's like aesthetically pleasing plant.
Yeah, so that would be that came to my mind immediately as a good option. All right, so there's a few ideas. Florin in Richland Center, your turn. Let's hear from you now. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Anyways, I like using cottonseed meal for fertilizer on my garden. And in the past, I've used Espoma organic cottonseed meal. And supposedly it says it's food grade. And now I found from Earthworks Health a cottonseed meal and quite a bit cheaper, but it says it contains gossypol, whatever that is, something about sterilizing people or something. It's a cattle grade. So just in the ground for a fertilizer, would that be okay to use instead of the organic food grade?
Well, I personally would be using the organic food grade, but I don't know. Josh, any idea on that?
Our garden, our edible garden, is the soil is so nice just after years of, the compost that we've added to it. I don't have a really good answer for that one. The question was just asking about, whether fertilizer was okay to use in it.
Well, this
thing,
right? Yeah, I think it was interested in cattle-grade cottonseed meal fertilizer is what he was. He's used the organic, but now he was considering using the cattle-grade of the cottonseed meal fertilizer and wondering if that was okay. And so unless it's listed on the, it's sort of like chemicals listings on a bottle. This reminds me of that in a way. If it's not listed for people grade, if it says cattle grade, I might be reluctant to do it. I don't know what you think, Reba. Mm-hmm.
I agree. I forget. There's some people in Extension who specifically teach food safety courses in terms of crops and food production, and I think those would be the people to talk to. I'm not remembering their names off the top of my head. I went through a course in Minnesota about this, where we were talking about doing a children's garden and all of the rules about washing your hands and making sure you put fertilizer or manure down a certain number of days before you harvest so that you don't have issues of contamination. And it seems like it would fall into this kind of a category.
Yeah. Who in horticulture might have an answer to that, do you think, Reba?
I'm trying to remember her name. So there's an extension agent in Wisconsin. I think her first name is Kristen, but I'll see if I can look her up and offer a recommendation.
Okay, Florin, just hang in there, stay listening, and we'll see if we can come back with an answer for you. Darlene in Lake Tomahawk will give you a chance. Hi, Darlene.
Hello. My comment is my grandmother had a huge garden in Wisconsin, and she grew things for medicinal reasons, different teas she would make. If you had an upset stomach, she would run and make you a tea, chamomile or whatever it was, depending on your complaint.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Darlene, Josh, comment?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we actually, chamomile, they really, they reseed easily. And I know every year we have, they're almost like an early cover crop almost in that kitchen garden section because we have so much of them. Yeah, I can definitely relate to that, collecting the flowers and using them in teas.
Thank you very much for calling, Darlene. Appreciate it. You can join in, too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us, the email address, ideas@WPR.org. Reba Lukin and Josh Steger of the Allen Centennial Gardens are guests today. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller. Two guests for you today from the Allen Centennial Garden. Reba Lukin is the director there, and Josh Steger directs horticulture with the Allen Centennial Garden. So great to have them both here. Questions for them. We've been talking about adding plants you can eat to your garden. It's a great way to use growing space. And you can join in. Number to call 1-800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. Let's take another call. Carolyn in Madison, we'll turn to you now. Carolyn, thanks for calling.
Hi. Speaking of plants you can eat, lamb's quarters is one of my favorites for salads or cooking or souffles and all sorts of things. So I hope you feature, introduce people to their weeds via lamb's quarters in one of the gardens anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. I actually, which I was talking about earlier, Black Forager actually featured lamb's quarters and I believe sauteed them in a pan and like served them over like rice or something. But yes, also with weeds, our favorite here, the garlic mustard, I know a lot of people will use that for pesto. And we have a lot of that on the west side of the garden that we're trying to keep down every year. So if anyone's hungry, you know, we have a lot of it in the spring. And, and we'll just make sure there's no flowers.
Yeah, use the leaves, right?
Yes.
Not the stems aren't involved in that too much, I don't think.
No.
So there you go. Thanks a lot for that call. Appreciate it. Becca in Menominee emailed. She has a large backyard native plant garden, and she's interspersed it with wild raspberries and wild strawberries, grapes, rhubarb, elderberries, and chives. And when she moved in, she was happy to see fiddlehead ferns growing in her garden, but she doesn't know how to prepare them or when to harvest them for preparation. So any tips? Reba first, maybe?
Well, my thoughts are early is usually better for fiddleheads and then maybe some butter. I think Josh is looking into that, but I did find the contact we were looking for earlier. So her name is Kristen Krokowski. I don't know if she pronounces it the Polish way or the American way, but she's an extension educator in Waukesha County, and she offers something called GAPS training, which is primarily for commercial growers, but I think it would answer that question that we had about fertilizer and food safety.
Kristen Krokowski, yeah, and has been a guest on the show, as a matter of fact, more than once. And that was back in relation to the question about the cottonseed? Yeah, cottonseed fertilizer that was being used. Josh, a comment on fiddlehead ferns?
Yeah, I was looking at that. You definitely want to harvest them when they're around like less than or around like 6 inches. And obviously you want it to be unfurled when you harvest it. But you can do a lot of things with them. It looks like you can like blanch them. You can roast them in the oven, add a little bit of feta cheese to that. You can saute them in a pan. But as long as you're catching them early enough where they're still really tight, that's when you want to do it. And that would be early spring.
Yeah, they're good. Is there, I mean, if you let them open, isn't there some issues that you would get into? Or is it a question of bitterness or is it a question of make you sick?
I'm not sure with that. I don't know. I feel like when they're tighter like that, I mean, they're a lot easier to eat that way, but
yeah, I think a lot of greens, it's taste primarily. Yeah. Like dandelions, I think you could eat any time if you wanted to, but they're a lot nicer to eat when they're fresh and not so bitter.
I could go along with that for sure. The garden is, and I want to bring this up, it was sort of in between calls here, that the garden has been hosting a number of classes, and the last one is a Saturday.
Right. Yeah. So every year with the collaboration of the Friends of Allen Centennial Garden, we host a winter class series. And the past 2 years we've had it on Zoom, instead of in person because of COVID-related concerns. Although we've gotten a lot of feedback that people like being able to go on a winter Saturday morning to a Zoom class rather than having to drive to campus. But anyway, this Saturday is our final installment, and we'll be having Thea Whitman from UW Soil Science Department join us to talk about soil organic matter and biochar, how to use that in your garden.
And those have, how have they all been received? Pretty well?
Pretty well, yeah. We've had really good attendance. People can register online through our Eventbrite, and it's $10 to come and free for Friends of Allen Centennial Garden members.
I want to go back to Becca for just a minute, who had emailed about her large backyard native garden. And I was thinking, gee, I wish I had a photo of that garden because it sounded really interesting to me, because she's got a native plant garden and she's put, you know, wild raspberries and wild strawberries and grapes and rhubarb and elderberries and chives. I'm just wondering, Josh, how that would look.
It's definitely very creative. I'm sure there's a lot of texture going on in there. I really like the biodiversity of plants that you have in that section. I think about, you know, different times of the year that the space is giving you different things to eat. I was especially intrigued by the elderberry that you have in there, because back in the day when I was an intern in like 2015, I remember a visitor talking about the elderberry we had right next to the house and how her grandmother, great-grandmother, would bread them and then deep fry them and then toss them in like a cinnamon sugar. And that's obviously with the buds, not after it's bloomed or anything. So when it's starting to bud, they would eat them. I remember sending me a recipe, and I think we featured it like in a Allen Centennial Garden cookbook way back in the day. I don't know where that is, unfortunately, but it was just like a really nice story to hear about that, you know, and the memory that gave her.
Well, now somebody's going to say, is that cookbook still available? I'm sure I'm going to get somebody asking that.
Right.
Is it available?
I think it's like in a PDF somewhere. I wish. I mean, if you want it to be available, I can make it happen, you know.
Well, it might work. It might work in a PDF.
Yeah.
What do you think, Reba?
I think I haven't come across it, but I'll let you know if I see it, Josh. What I was going to say is another plant that I've learned about that you can eat at different stages is cattails, which might be kind of surprising. Mm. But there's this book. It's Plants Have So Much to Give Us, All We Have to Do Is Ask. And it's written by an indigenous Ojibwe faculty person who used to work, I forget at which UW campus. But anyway, in there she has a whole section about cattails and when you could eat different parts of it. So you could eat like the buds at certain times. You can eat the shoots when they're really fresh. And apparently there's this mucus at the bottom of the cattail, and it works as like a soup thickener, sort of like an energy cube you might eat if you're running or something. So there's a whole bunch of different ways to make use of plants that I certainly haven't done before.
But. Well, no, but there's another. What was the name of that book again?
Plants Have So Much to Give Us, All We Have to Do Is Ask.
Plants Have So Much to Give Us, All We Have to Do Is Ask. I bet Jill Nadeau or somebody's writing that down, and maybe we'll have that person on the show. Who knows? It's not a topic I think that we've ever covered, or at least that, but we certainly haven't talked about that book, at least in my memory, for sure. Well, our guest today, Reba Lucan, one of our guests, is the director of the Allen Centennial Garden, and Josh Steger is director of horticulture at the Allen Centennial Garden, as we talked with them about growing edibles within your garden. It's always great to hear about the Allen Gardens. And, you know, somebody wondered, how big is the Allen Garden anyway? And What? How? What acreage is it? Is it an acre? 2 acres?
It's between 2 and 2.5 acres.
Mm-hmm.
I've been there at all seasons, pretty much all seasons of the year, and spring, summer, and fall in particular, and kind of look through the gate, look through the fence in the wintertime a bit. And there's always something different, depending on the season. There's always something that you can see at the Allen Centennial Garden, a beautiful place right on the University of Wisconsin campus. And while you're there, you kind of got a view of Lake Mendota while you're there. And certainly coming and going, you would have a good view of it. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with us today from the Allen Centennial Garden. Our director, Reba Lukin, and Josh Steger, who is director of horticulture at the garden. So great to have them with us. We've been talking about adding edible ornamental plants to your garden. I take some other gardening questions as well. Maybe you're looking for a plant for a specific spot in your garden. What questions do you have about garden design? Love to hear from you. You can call us at 800-642-1234 or email us to ideas@wpr.org. ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Veronica emailed to ask if she should be concerned about the ice that's in her garden. Apparently a layer of ice, and wondering if it's going to hurt the plants. Josh, what do you think?
No, I wouldn't be too concerned. I mean, Wisconsin, I mean, it really depends on the type of plants she has. Obviously, if they're natives, I think they're definitely well-adjusted enough to handle that. If they are, let's say, perennials that are a little bit more tender, or like, maybe a type of cultivar or something. Overall, I still wouldn't be super concerned. I think they're just fine. That's what happens in the winter. So
yeah, I mean, if that ice layer hung around a long, long time, which I doubt that it's going to this year, there might be some cause, if it was leaking into when these plants are supposed to be starting to come out of the ground, that'd be one thing. But sure, just the normal snow and ice shouldn't be a problem. Reba, you're agreeing with that as well.
Yeah, I was thinking, like, snow is really good for plants, right? It covers them and keeps them insulated. I would say the only thing I'm worried about with the ice maybe is the water, right? The ice melts and then you have really wet soil there for a little bit. Ice itself probably doesn't seem too concerning.
Josh, how did the pandemic affect your work at Allen Centennial Garden?
The last few years, I guess it has been a few years now, it's kind of crazy. Starting out, the first year with the pandemic, it was really tough because we have a really great volunteer group that give their time at the garden. And when we weren't able to see them on a regular basis and for them to come out and support the garden, it was really tough on us. At the time, there was maybe 3 or 4 staff, including me. So we had to make sure that we took care of things that, some things took priority over others, should I say.
Sure.
So The last few years, we have been catching up on a lot of the weeds, and I'm sure if any of my volunteers are listening or whatever, they'll be agreeing and shaking their heads and laughing and probably shaking their fist at me, too, because it's been a lot of weeding. But I think that's it's a lot of playing catch-up right now, and it was really weird to not see a whole lot of visitors come through anymore, because when we, you know, throughout the day, you would have people coming in and out and talking to you, and I felt like the first year especially, you know, you're just kind of came into the garden, you had to do what you needed to do, and then you left. And that was kind of university, the policy at the time too. Like, you came to campus when you needed to, you got your job done, and you went back home. So, but it's really nice to see people again. We opened things up this last year, and we were still safe, and everyone was like so excited to see each other, and the garden, you know, like I said, playing a lot of catch up and everything. So it was nice to see everyone again for sure.
Yeah. Reba, how many volunteers are there at the garden?
That's a great question. We don't have a total count. So that's something that we're working on, is figuring out how many volunteers exactly we have, and getting everyone to report their hours when they do them is always a little bit of a challenge, but we had over 100 people last year who we were letting know about volunteer opportunities, all the way from students through seniors. A lot of master gardeners come and volunteer at Allen Centennial Garden. And we're always looking for more help. So right now we have a form on our website. If people want to come out and volunteer, we usually have opportunities on Tuesday and Wednesday mornings in the summer. And we welcome people to come. Let us know ahead of time, of course, but whenever you're available. You don't have to come every Tuesday or every Wednesday. We're pretty flexible when people are available.
Yeah. And the Family Garden Day is back in person this year, if I'm not mistaken. And talk about that. It's in May, isn't it, usually?
Right, yeah. It's the first Saturday in May. It's from, I think, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m., and it will be on campus again May 7th this year. We'll have the traditional pasta packs people can take home and plant basil and tomatoes in their own garden. We'll have activities at Allen Centennial Garden, something to get your hands, you know, on with plants. And then other opportunities throughout campus. You can follow our trail and visit the Discovery Center and other places, too.
And the summer concert series, that's held in, I think that starts in June. Describe that.
Yeah, so every year, including last year, we had to take a break for the first year of the pandemic, but we have a summer concert series. It's free, open to the public, and it's every other Sunday from about 5 to 6:15. We have usually jazz performers come and perform in the garden. So it's a great opportunity to come with family of all ages, sit in the garden, enjoy or walk around and see the flowers with some tunes in the background. And the first one this year, like you said, is Sunday, June 11th.
June
12th. June 12th is the Sunday.
Is it a free event?
Yeah, it's free. So the trick is just finding parking, of course, on campus. So there's some spots across the street, and ground parking is free on the weekends on campus.
I think lot 46 is right across the, well, I know it is because I park my car there every day.
There you go.
That's a really handy, because that could handle pretty much everybody who would want to be there, I think, on a Saturday or on a Sunday. So that's wonderful. Carrie in Duluth emailed, she knows potatoes were grown as ornamentals by Europeans before they figured out they were edible. So she's played with adding some in her mixed beds. Is there a potato variety that might be more attractive in a garden that you could recommend?
I don't know. Well, Josh maybe has an answer to that. But what I was talking to a professor last fall about putting potatoes in the garden specifically because most people who grow potatoes will prune off the flowers so that they don't produce fruit. But as it turns out, the potatoes are in the same family as tomatoes. So they actually produce these little bitty berries. And she really, because she was an ethnobotany professor, wanted her students to be able to see it's in the nightshade family. They have very similar characteristics. They have similar fruit and flowers and leaves as tomatoes and peppers and eggplants and other things like that. So I think that's really cool to grow them as ornamentals and see that whole life stage and not just eat the roots.
Yeah. Josh, comment?
I know a few, was it Reva, like when you came on board like last year or something, we had all the potatoes in the garden that Tom grew.
I think over winter, they did overwintered potatoes. Yeah,
a few of them. Yeah, we literally just planted like 5 or 6 different varieties of potatoes. And I mean, yeah, all the foliage kind of looked the same, but the potatoes looked really pretty. So I don't know of any in particular, like above ground, something that would really stand out off the top of my head. Sorry. I will say, like, the foliage of potatoes is really cool, though. I mean.
Yeah, I like the, yeah. I like the look of it as well. Ryan emailed to ask for suggestions for a shady spot in his yard. He has good soil, but it's pretty shady all day, and he's looking for perennials.
Ooh, okay. So shady, good soil. It really depends on if your soil is dry or if, you know, it's wet. I think, so I always love to use different types of sedges. Those are always a really nice ground layer kind of filler. Something that I've tried recently that I really like and is, actually has a bloom time later in the season, like September, October, is Rhabdosia longituba. It's something like that. And it's in the mint family. So it's with salvia. It's related to salvia. They have the square stems and everything. And the flowers are kind of like a periwinkle color. And the foliage is kind of like a greenish yellow color. What I really like about it, like I said, is that it blooms like September, October. And it does really well in shady conditions with good soil.
Yeah, Reba, anything to add to that? What other plants work well in shady spots?
Well, this is kind of an interesting question for me because I grew up at a home with every garden was in the shade. So all the plants I know best are the shady ones. And of course, we had lots of hosta, which I'm sure is something that the question asker is familiar with. I always loved spring ephemerals also. Those are the ones that come up really early in the spring before the trees leaf out. And so, you know, things like, I don't know, Josh, what are your favorite ephemerals?
I love bloodroots. I think they're so cool. I also like the shooting stars, which is something a little bit later in the spring. The toothworts are always really nice. Trout lilies. I don't know. I'm pretty much naming off all the native Wisconsin ephemerals. They're all really amazing. I would have to say some of my favorites are bloodroots, though, for sure.
And you mentioned hostas, Reba, and there's so many types of varieties of hostas out there now that you could have a wonderful garden of hostas.
Absolutely. Yes. I don't know if the one I remember, of course, is the big blue umbrella one, right? That is just gigantic and that interesting color. It's not just the green, but it's that dark, deep blue green color. But there's all kinds of ones with different variegation and frilly edges, all kinds of exciting things. I think they're exciting. And I think, actually, speaking of edibles, I've heard you might be able to eat them.
Hostas?
That's what I've heard.
Oh,
early spring again, right before they get, you know, thick. But again, I think they're related to plantains somehow.
Mm-hmm.
They're lilies, so
plantain lily.
there we go. I always learn something on Garden Talk here. The garden is involved in a new market science program. I think you may have mentioned it earlier, but it was worth talking about.
Yeah, so this year we got a grant to do some science communication at local farmers markets. So we'll be at the Westside Market and maybe a couple other places in July and August this year with students talking about science research related to plants and other things going on and trying to offer some hands-on opportunities that draw in children and families and people of all ages to get really engaged with what's going on with the science. When I did this before, I put up this big board and I had people vote, is a cucumber a fruit or a vegetable? To kind of try and, you know, pull apart, it is maybe both of those things, depending on the definitions you're using, right? So it's a fruit if you're thinking botanically, but if you're cooking and you're talking about nutrition, we always consider it a vegetable. So it's kind of the old argument about tomatoes, but put in a new light. So hopefully we'll have some exciting questions like that at the farmer's market this year.
So the Madison Farmer's Market, every week?
Well, so we'll be at not the main one in the square, but on the West Side Farmer's Market, and we'll be there like 5 or 6 weeks in the middle of the summer.
Oh, man, that sounds wonderful. Josh, besides adding edibles to the garden, give us an update on what else is going on in the garden in the way of planting and so forth this year.
Oh, man. So, with this autumn harvest theme, you know, going beyond that, one thing that I really focus on in the garden are the spaces where a lot of weddings are. You know, we're in the background, and I just want to make sure everything looks really beautiful. And recently, we've tried some new plantings around the pergola. Before, the beds around them were kind of filled with just your basic plants. Nothing that really stood out. It was like maybe some of the Japanese forest grass. And this last year we introduced some just like your basic alocasias, like the giant green alocasias. And I'm excited to try those again because they just thrived in that area because the soil was wet. And it's nothing like super new, you know, to horticulture, but the way they softened the pillars of the pergola, and it just provided such a nice backdrop to like wedding photos and everything. That's something that I really want to focus on again this year. I'm trying to think what else. Reba, do you know of anything else?
Before we go to Reba, just repeat that plant again, because somebody's going to say, wait a minute, I didn't hear that, and I might want to put it on my own pergola.
Sure. It's the Alocasia calidora. Just like your generic, I want to say like, well, there's calocasia, which is elephant ear, but alocasia, as they say, they like point upward like an arrow.
Yeah.
So alocasias, they're green. They grow. There's so many different types of varieties. This is just the generic green one, and they can grow anywhere from like, I don't know, 3 feet to 7 feet or more. I mean, when we got ours, they were like literally a foot tall, and they were, and I'm 6'3", they were like almost as tall as me. So and that was over a growing season. It's incredible like what that type of soil around the pergola, and like that's another example of looking at the right type of soil in sight, you know, working with what you have. We had clay soil around the pergola, and we found a plant that thrived in that area.
Yeah, perfect. Reba, a comment?
I think the other major plant that we're talking about putting in the garden right now is on the terrace that we have. We cut down our old linden tree, and so we're going to be replacing that with a new apple. So that will be a new thing to visit in the garden. Hopefully we'll get fruit on there, and then we'll have the variety we picked. Now I don't remember the name of it, but it's supposed to have red flesh. So when you bite into it, instead of being white inside, it'll be red. That's another excitement and edible in the garden this year.
I'm trying to remember what variety that would be. Oh, gosh, it's not coming to me either. You know, you were talking about wet and different soil types, and another person emailed looking for dry, full sun in the afternoon, and the soil isn't great. So you got poor soil, and you got full sun in the afternoon, and it's kind of a dry area.
Sounds like something to water regularly. I don't know, Josh. Do you have any thoughts about
this? Is for perennials or for like edible gardening?
I think just looking for ideas for probably ideas. Anything that would fit in an area like that.
So like when I'm stumped to look for plants or whatever, I know Flower Factory still has their website up, and you can actually other like gardening sites or like nurseries will have filters that you can put in the search engine and I to help me out and find out some other plants that I want to try. Just like check the dry soils, full sun, whatever, and then you'll get a list of plants that come up that thrive in those types of conditions. It's like a nice little hack that I've kind of learned over the years when I can't think of anything else of what I already know.
And it makes good sense too. Karen in La Crosse emailed. She's enjoying this talk about planting and harvesting edibles. And she comments that older people seem to know a lot about growing and preparing herbs and ornamentals for medicinal uses and general health. An interesting partnership for Allen Garden stewards may be to invite older people to share their memories, recipes, and knowledge about the healthful benefits of these plants. Sounds like a cool idea, Reba.
I think that's a great idea, and it's something I've noticed too. People, say immigrants from other countries, often bring with them some more knowledge about plants that they've eaten and maybe kept those traditions alive more than at least my family and background we've done. So,
yeah, it's a nice idea and worth thinking about for sure. Johanna in New Richmond emailed to ask you to share any advice on how to go about replacing lawn with native grasses and plants beneficial to bees and butterflies. She wonders if she should start with seeds or plants in the spring, and probably some combination would be in order. But I think you really need to, if you're going to replace the lawn, you really need to make sure you're rid of the lawn and any weeds that might be in the lawn before you go with natives.
Yeah, this is something that I love to talk about. I could talk about for a long time. Depending on the type of lawn that you already have, you could literally just rent a solder like from Home Depot or something, and just like scoop it up that way. But you know, if it's a small section, you could always try smothering the site for a season to kill off the grass and any type of weeds, especially perennial weeds that are living in your lawn.
They need to go.
And then what was that?
They need to go.
So it's important to do that and make sure that you take your time doing it. You don't rush it because, you know, if you start to plant your plants in and your seeds, they're going to be competing with these weeds that are still existing in the site. So it's important to do it right the first time. I feel like going from there, plugs and seeds, and
there you go.
Beautiful.
I tell you what, I thank you so much, both of you, for being with us today. Reba Lukin and Josh Steger from the Allen Centennial Garden. Take a look at the garden. They're wonderful. You can go online, too, and take a look what they've got online. You'll get some ideas from it as well. Well, Bassam Shakashiri comes back on Monday to talk about science, and the weather guys are back as well. There's lots to talk about there. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller.